The Case of the Disappearing Lady. After my initial surprise of Holmes's return and his series of adventure, in which he solved so many new mysteries, I must now reveal the most obscure following episode in the life of this splendid detective and scientist. I have kept these facts away from the public too long, because of the scrutiny with which Sherlock Holmes' reputation should be saved for later generation. I was wrong to believe this. I realized it was my own reputation I was trying to protect. Holmes would have laughed in my face for my overblown ethics and false sense of solidarity. Not that he would not have appreciated my friendship, believe me you, but solely because it was not in his nature to care about such trivialities. The period in Holmes's life on which I'm currently reporting caught me by surprise, and so completely it totally left me helpless and renderless and vulnerable to that side of his life which he opened up to me after a conversation we had in the privacy of our past thought exchanges. As you, the reader, might recall from earlier reports, one evening, Holmes invited me to his chambers to celebrate the solution of an extremely difficult case involving the disappearance of a number of individuals. He called his Alpha Omega collapse and explained to me that it was a hypothetical solution he still wanted to follow up. Needless to say, as you will agree after reading this story, it scared the hell out of me and became one of the most bizarre episodes in my life. For the record, I will first explain the background of this hideous history. The streets of London were never more misty and gloomy than that specific night. The silence was disturbed every once in a while by the cries of those poor souls which the Thames would never ever give back to life. Too many hardships for the families of those who had never learned to swim. With this fog, the cries would soon wither away, as nobody would be able to find the fallen in time, saving them from drowning. The police was in the habit of calling these foggy nights the white and wet death. Holmes and I sat quietly in front of the fireplace at his rooms in Baker Street. The cries of the drowning victims were at a distance, yet it made me wish Holmes would take up his violin, even though he could not play a single note of music. I would welcome his violin's cat cries above all the vague and distant death rattles which violated my mind. Both of us enjoyed smoking a pipe, though I preferred cigarettes from time to time. We sat silently, concentrating on the burning woodblocks in the fireplace. There was a short but firm knock on the door, and Mrs. Hudson entering, bringing with her Inspector Lestrade. His nervous radiation immediately filled the room and broke our intimate atmosphere of silence. "Dear friend Lestrade," Holmes welcomed him, "do come in and set yourself by the fire. You look as if you have seen a ghost." The warm welcome words changed Lestrade's face from nervous towards despair. His upper lip trembled somewhat as he answered,
"I feel I did, Mr. Holmes."
"Well, well, come now, my dear fellow," Holmes uttered. "I know ghosts exist, but I'm quite sure one would never cross your path." These strange expressions Holmes was in a habit of using, and they do not surprise me now, but back then they puzzled me as I could not understand the message behind them. I thought they were jokes, but Holmes's serious face led me to believe otherwise. Lestrade was upset to be puzzled by Holmes's words. "I cannot believe what happened," he mumbled. "Not what happened at all, not at all." "But, dear fellow, do tell us," Holmes insisted. "We got a report of a missing person, a young woman,
who was believed to have wandered on her own and fell in one of the canals surrounding the Thames. People could hear her shout for help, and upon targeting the location, they were pretty sure they had located her. However, once arriving at the scene, her cries stopped, and they did not find her. "Oh, how awful!" I uttered in shock. "She drowned just before you could get to her?" "Actually, no," Lestrade replied, moving his gaze from Holmes to me. "She was not there, but neither any water. Yet her cries, however distinctly, told the seekers where she was and what was happening." "Could they not have mistaken?" I dared ask. "What can be mistaken about the words, 'Help, I fell in the water and I am drowning'?" Lestrade still had this baffled gaze in his eyes. "I see. I felt rather stupid. Quite so."
The Case of the Disappearing Lady, Chapter 2. Holmes had not said a word during Lestrade's story. He just looked with concentration, focusing on a point in midair. It was a typical look of his, and it gave me a bit of the creeps because it awakened the feeling that he was seeing something which could not be seen by others, as if he was actually communicating with the unseen. I knew, of course, that this rationality would never allow him to stray from his exact interpretation of facts, his data gathering, and his love for reality. Yet even the hardest felt scientist should be allowed some moments of inspiration, and some of these moments might not come from science. After this short, faraway look, Holmes quickly returned to this world, and there was a glare of enthusiastic fire in his eyes when he said, "Lestrade, do tell us all the details. Who was this mysterious woman? Who were his rescuers? And everything you can come up with. As you know, I cannot advise you if you do not tell me everything you could possibly have observed." "But, Mr. Holmes, I fear there is not much more to tell." "There always is, Lestrade, there always is. Give it a try. You will find you have more to tell than you think you do. Start with the main characters." Lestrade, still looking a bit baffled, started to give his account of the facts. "The woman was about to be married into the royal family. She was not an English woman, which might account for the fact that she did not bother with safety precautions we English take in weather like this. Where did she come from originally?" "Hungary, but there was some rumor concerning the genius of her descent. Actually, nobody had seen her yet except the prince. You can imagine the state of the royal family now. They did not even meet with the parents of this young woman yet. They were supposed to meet the woman herself this evening for the first time." "My dear fellow, you forget some important facts. For instance, does this woman have a name?" "Oh yes, of course, Mr. Holmes. How stupid of me. Her name was Nudgy. Isobel Nudgy." "What a strange name, pray do continue, Lestrade." "Well, on the way to the theatre, where the meeting between Miss Nudgy, the prince, and the royal family was about to take place, in fact, only 1 minute before, she suddenly disappeared. The prince was about to introduce her to the parents, but when he turned around, she was gone. The company stood amidst surprise when they became aware of her cries in the dark and the splashing of water. And rushing after the cries, as I told you, it amounted to nothing. She was not there, and there was not a canal in sight. The site where she supposed to drown is for long under construction. It is reserved for the creation of a fountain housing a special highlight which should enlighten the front of the newly to build wing of the Palladium Theater in the near future. Its construction should have been finished within a month. Well, 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 Holmes uttered as if saving time to think. And nobody but the prince ever met this lady before?
I am quite sure that is the case. The prince, of course, is heartbroken.
Well, well, well. It was unlike Holmes to repeat himself like this. Neither did he give way to any solution towards the mystery, but he looked exceedingly worried.
Watson, he suddenly shouted, as if fearing himself away from the dark side of his thoughts, let's go.
Go where? I asked, while Holmes started to push Lestrade towards the door.
Mrs. Hodgson, shouting again, could you please see Mr. Lestrade out? I have important business to attend to.
Of course you'll understand, Lestrade.
But, Mr. Holmes, could you not help me in this case?
Lestrade, trust me. To bring it to its natural conclusion, there's nothing we can do, I'm afraid. Neither is there anything to prevent more of these happenings. Lestrade looked again baffled. He moved towards the door, took on his coat and hat, and left like a disappointed puppy dog, pushed away by its master. I felt really sorry for him and turned towards Holmes. He looked at me with these glittering eyes as if the dark moments had completely disappeared.
Watson, the game is afoot.
He took his walking cane, a particularly priceless piece, wooden with inlaid ivory motifs, and jumped over the pedestal. I wondered why he wanted his cane, but experience led me not to ask. To be sure, asking questions at such moments, I knew was quite useless. So off we went.
I take it, Lestrade, that the family will be in the area of the Palladium?
He shouted.
Yes, Mr. Holmes, Lestrade shouted after him, baffled.
Holmes called for a carriage, and when it came, he rushed me into it.
Off to the Palladium Theatre, driver, and fast as you please.
Sirs, the driver replied, this is a dangerous night for speed. My horse, my trip. Nay, it is almost impossible to see anything up front.
Very well, then, as fast as you can, Holmes answered in his impatient fashion.
The horse seemed to sense the prospective dangers, and the driver did not push it beyond its limits.
Holmes stuck out his head from the side window, smelling the evening air.
Pulling back in, he remarked,
"Do you smell the strange fragrance of acetone?"
I vaguely smelled the fragrance, but I thought nothing of it. With so many factories in the London area, pretty much everything smelled.
Yet Holmes' expressions looked rather alarmed, as if he had seen all of this before.
This is not good, he mumbled.